Welcome to On the Issues with Michelle Goodwin at Ms. Magazine. As you know, we're a show that reports, rebels, and we tell it just like it is. And in this episode of 15 Minutes of Feminism, we are diving right in, and you know we count the time in our own feminist terms. In this episode, I'm joined by Anthony Michael Kreis. He is a professor at Georgia State University, really one of the leading thinkers on matters of election law, and he's been covering closely the litigation that has involved the former president, Donald Trump, including the criminal investigations and prosecutions taking place in Georgia. You've heard him before on our series where we are unpacking the Trump indictments. In this episode, we're turning to what's happening in Washington, D.C., but as a backdrop, before we get there, let's unpack a little bit about the Supreme Court's recent decision involving the Colorado case. As you know, in Colorado, the former president had been taken off of the ballot because of his engagement in the January 6th insurrection, according to that state Supreme Court and also its district court. To give some background, the 14th Amendment, Section 3, indicates that officers may not hold office if they have been involved in an insurrection or given aid or comfort to individuals who've attempted to insurrect against the United States. District court in Colorado had ruled that, in fact, Donald Trump, based on factual evidence heard before the district court, that he had, in fact, engaged in an insurrection. The question left open from the district court was whether the term officer applied to the United States president, or in this case, the former president. The case was then heard by the Colorado Supreme Court, and they ruled that a former president was, in fact, an office holder holding office within the context of the 14th Amendment, Section 3. The Trump legal team challenged that ruling, and the Supreme Court of the United States decided to take it up with great speed. And in a ruling that was just recently issued, the United States Supreme Court, in what appeared to be unanimous, but with a very strong concurrence leaning in another direction of the three liberals on the court, Justices Kagan, Sotomayor, and Ketanji Brown Jackson, revealed something else. And in fact, now with greater analysis from Slate, Mark Joseph Stern, there appears that there was metadata that suggests that for Justice Sotomayor, part of her opinion in this case was a dissent. Now, coming out of this case, one might say that the Chief Justice, John Roberts, wanted the appearance that the court was uniform in its understanding of the 14th Amendment, Section 3, and the states attempting to regulate in this domain. The court essentially said that it is not up to states to determine whether federal people running for federal office can be on the ballot or not. Of course, there are great gaps in the decision because that's exactly what states do. States actually handle that enforcement power. For example, the Constitution has age requirements. It has citizenship requirements. Who takes care of that? Not Congress. Who takes care of that? Not agencies. Who takes care of that? Before this case, certainly not the Supreme Court, but actually states who take care of that enforcement element. And each state determines who gets to be on their ballot by the number of signatures that the individuals and their team amasses, along with other factors. Needless to say, there's tremendous division with regard to the Supreme Court's decision. There are Americans who've already lost faith and confidence in the United States Supreme Court. In fact, the court has the lowest approval rating of any time since approval ratings have been measured. Americans are feeling as if the court engages in outcome determinativism. And what that basically means is that the court is selective. It's already determined how it's going to rule when it takes up cases. Years ago, that would have been unheard of, and for pundits to suggest that, or legal scholars, they would have been scoffed at. The idea being that our United States Supreme Court does not see itself as a political branch of government. Rather, the justices who are federally appointed are not beholden to any president or political party. Well, in recent years, Americans have come to question that. And in part, that's because the former president, Donald Trump, has made clear that he had an agenda with the judges and justices that he appointed. One might say that the justices perhaps bristle when the former president makes clear that he had an agenda coming into office, and that he believes that the judges and justices that he has appointed have carried out his agenda. Certainly, he's pointed to that with regard to reproductive health rights and justice with the gutting of Roe v. Wade. But there are other areas, too, in which the former president has made clear that his appointments were deeply political, and that the people who are now serving due to his nominations understand what their role is to be. Now, with that backdrop, there are Americans who wonder whether anything can be trusted that comes out of the United States Supreme Court, particularly now, given this ruling in the Colorado case, and then also by the Supreme Court deciding to take up the case as to whether the former president has absolute immunity when being charged with a crime. And this gets us to the DC Circuit Court of Appeals case, where a three-judge panel ruled that the former president is not above the law, that he is no different than any other American citizen when it's been alleged that he has committed a crime. The defense team representing the former president has said that past presidents, present presidents, and presidents in the future all enjoy something called absolute immunity, which means that they are shielded from criminal prosecution. In the DC Circuit Court of Appeals case, it's a case that is alleging that the former president sought to interfere with the 2020 presidential election. That is a case that is now on hold, meaning that pre-trial matters were underway. The trial was due to begin in March. The Supreme Court has now said that they will hear oral arguments later in April. And basically, there's nothing to be done with regard to the case until the Supreme Court hears the case and presumably issues its ruling, which likely would come before the end of this term. But depending upon when that is, it might be that the case isn't picked back up, if at all, until sometime in the late summer or early fall. There's much to unpack with this and so much more. As I mentioned, I'm joined by Anthony Michael Kreiss in this episode, and here we are building on a prior conversation, one that involved the case in Georgia, where we talked about the hearings involving the prosecutor there and the controversy over whether the prosecutor should be taken off of the case and the claims that there was some form of a conflict of interest. That case has still not been resolved, though may be soon. Whether Fannie Willis is taken off the case, or a judge rules that there's no conflict of interest here because a conflict would mean that somehow she was entangled with the Trump defense team or something like that, no matter which way that case goes, the former president is being prosecuted in the state of Georgia. There is audio tape evidence that is being used in that case. And now, with more than 90 indictments, something that has no precedent in American history, with multiple litigations, New York and Georgia, Washington, D.C., and other parts of the country, involving insurrection, involving interference. The litigation involves sexual assault. The E. Jean Carroll case, now there have been two very significant verdicts against the former president, and the payout is in the tens of millions now. It's not including the New York case involving fraud, not only with the former president, but also his business partners. He's responsible now for paying out nearly $500 million. With all that said, let's turn to this interview with Professor Anthony Michael Kreiss as he helps to give us some sense of what's coming next in at least one of the former president's trials. Professor Anthony Michael Kreiss, thank you so very much for joining us. You have been a stalwart with us for our Trump indictment series going back to last year and covering the various matters that involve the former president, as now he faces more than 90 indictments and state, federal, civil suits, criminal lawsuit matters. We've been talking with you about Georgia and the Georgia RICO case, where there are more than 30 non-indicted co-conspirators. There are indicted conspirators that are being prosecuted. And of course, the former president is also being prosecuted. And in that case, it's about trying to interfere with the Georgia elections, including the former president being caught on audio tape, which the whole nation and world has heard. But there's also the DC Circuit Court of Appeals case as well. And I'd like for us to unravel that because that's also been in the news lately. Can you level set a bit for our listeners who have been absorbed in Georgia but now need to be focusing on DC as well?
Yeah, so of course we're in a kind of a complex stage of the litigation in DC, where things have been on hold for a while. And the reason for that is, of course, because as the pretrial process has gone forward, Donald Trump raised a motion that he is immune from prosecution as a matter of Article II powers, right? The presidency wraps him in this immunity for all the different acts that he ever took as president. And he claims that his actions leading up to January 6th were essentially presidential official acts. And therefore, a prosecution is not permitted under our constitutional system. And Judge Chutkan very ably, and I think thoroughly debunked that notion in denying the idea of blanket presidential immunity. But of course, that was appealed. And so the DC Circuit it had the case before them, and that was decided very recently, again against Donald Trump, and held that the president is not categorically immune for acts that are deemed criminal, right? That the president has an obligation to faithfully execute the law, and that the president can't just willfully ignore the commands of Congress through federal criminal law. And so, if you get prosecuted for violating the criminal law, it is because the president has essentially, abdicated their duty to faithfully be, right, the chief law enforcement officer essentially of the United States. And so now that has been appealed to the Supreme Court. And we'll have to see whether or not the Supreme Court decides to take that up. But the big issue, of course, is that as these appeals have been going forward and the cases have been percolating through the federal system, Judge Chutkan has put everything on pause in the trial court. And so while the court in the DC Circuit ruled fairly expeditiously, it took them just about a month to get this from oral argument into print. Every day that it takes the Supreme Court to wait and consider whether to take this or what to do with this, or if they're going to hear it, and if a decision gets rendered after during the summer, every day that takes to finish is a day that Donald Trump is not being tried for these crimes or alleged crimes. And so the real issue, I think, is for most folks is not whether or not the Supreme Court will uphold the D.C. Circuit's ruling. I think most observers think they will. But the big question is, how quickly can they get it done? Because at the end of the day, we were originally looking at a March trial in D.C. And now we're probably thinking maybe we're looking at June, July, August. And there are collateral right issues there because there are other trials for which Donald Trump also has to be present. So there's a March 25th trial date set now for the criminal trial in New York for Donald Trump. So that'll take about 6 weeks, it's assumed. So right now we're thinking March, April, maybe early May, maybe a mid to late summer trial for the DC case, but that Jack Smith has brought as special counsel, but that then has a consequence for the Georgia case. And so the Georgia case was originally slated for a goal trial date of August 2024. And now we're thinking maybe that won't happen. And so there's a big question about timing and how this gums up, not just this case, but has consequences for other cases outside of it.
Well, let's unpack this a little bit more, because January 6th was so recent, but yet with so much. I mean, we've had the E. Jean Carroll case. There's been Georgia, as you've mentioned. There's Colorado. There's being kicked off the ballot in Maine. There's very recently in New York, the Trump Organization being found to have committed fraud and therefore no longer able to do business for a period of time in New York, along with a pretty hefty fine. So let's remind our listeners what DC is actually about and some of the defenses that have been made, one of which you spoke to, which is that the former president's legal team has said that he has what they've described as absolute immunity. And it is true that government officials can have qualified immunity in very narrow instances, absolute immunity. But that is providing some form of a shield for government officials as they are doing what is within the nature of their work, such that they do not come under a civil penalty or criminal penalties when they're just simply carrying out the duties of their office. And his defense team said, well, presidents, past, sitting, future presidents have this kind of immunity where they're completely protected, that there are, no penalties associated with doing what is their work. And as you mentioned, Judge Chalkin said that there is no such thing that shields a president from liability associated with crimes, that there is no president that is above the law, essentially, in terms of lay person's translation. And that was challenged by his legal team. There were some pretty artful kinds of arguments and examples that were given with the defense team, which were really quite extraordinary. If you might offer some of that to our listeners.
Yeah, the one that was really interesting was the idea that if a president is impeached for a particular act and the Senate acquits them, that also means that they're immune from subsequent prosecution for the underlying act. Now, that's really interesting because the Constitution, of course, says very specifically that if a person is convicted and removed from office for an impeachable act by the United States Senate, that does not render them immune from subsequent prosecution. And that provision of the Constitution, I think, is meant to be very clear that two things are true. One, that unlike in England, the Senate as a jury doesn't have the capacity to impose criminal-like sanctions on somebody for an impeachable offense. So if Donald Trump, for example, had been convicted and removed for his conduct on January 6th in the second impeachment trial, the Senate couldn't subsequently immediately say, okay, Donald Trump, and you go to prison for 10 years. That was the case in England for some time. And so the Constitution was meant to expressly delineate that process, that kind of criminal, a criminal law hat was in an inappropriate one for the United States Senate to wear. And so the argument was essentially, right, that impeachment has this this kind of interactive effect with the ability to prosecute somebody. Now, of course, one of the great examples then that one of the judges, I think it was Judge Pan, brought up was, you know, could Donald Trump or a president generally, call up SEAL Team 6 and say, hey, assassinate my, my political competitor, or my political enemy or whoever. And so long as, so long as they essentially left office immediately before they could be impeached, convicted and removed, then they wouldn't suffer any criminal liability for that. And of course, that's just a nonsensical position, but that's essentially the theory that
the position, right, taken by the defense team.
And of course, they said, well, no president would ever get away with that. Of course, they would be convicted and removed. But again, right, if they immediately resigned upon the discovery of this, or if they left office before somebody realized it, then they would basically be immune and to do whatever they wish. And that just simply can't be.
So what about the argument that really this was about free speech? This is about First Amendment, which protects an individual and their ability to freely speak, the ability to freely associate, which is what the president, former president, was doing on January 6th. He was speaking, he was associating, he was assembling. All of these things are protected by the First Amendment. There may be some that are persuaded by that argument. What of that?
Well, I think it's important to acknowledge first and foremost that speech on its own is generally not a crime, with the rare exception, right, the rarest of exceptions of inciting, unlawful violence, right? And that incitement is, has very strict standards that are applied to in order to protect political speech and still allow the criminalization in a very narrow category of speech, right, that creates an imminent lawless violence. But the idea that speech has never, that speech related to conduct is somehow off limits is kind of absurd, right? We prosecute people all the time for things that are, or speech that is attendant to their underlying crime. So, for example, if you walk into a bank with a mask and a weapon, and, maybe you don't say anything and you just kind of like do your transaction and you leave. Okay. I don't know if that's a crime per se, but you go in and you say, stick them up, right? That speech is now part of, what was your criminal, what was your intent? Was it criminal, or were you just going to a Halloween parade and you had to, make a withdrawal on your way to the bank, right? There would be two different scenarios, one in which the speech is incredibly important to determining, right, the person's motive, the effect on the listener, how that happened subsequently, right? Did they turn over money because you said, hey, I'm robbing you, right? And so that's a very similar
thing. What did you do? Here, I mean, this is actually very interesting because you're also speaking then to two things. The one is that speech is the protection of free speech is not absolute. Right, there are time, place, and manner restrictions that are placed on speech, but you're also speaking back to evidence and what is the kind of evidence, what did January 6th look like, and that these are matters that will be taken into account. How long did it take for the former president to engage with calling security? Was he aware of what was actually taking shape as individuals were storming the Capitol and violence was being committed and people were being injured, harmed, and the deaths that were resulting and the hours that it took before he took to some social media platform to express that people should calm themselves, but how much of that did he know? And all of those kinds of things would be unpacked once this trial is able to get underway.
Right. I mean, and that's the ironic part of this is that the speech that the lawyers are railing against being used in this indictment, they're doing it because they're being zealous advocates, but it is, right, it's inculpatory. But you can bet, right, that speech, when it's exculpatory, they would immediately jump on it and say, right, this shows his intent, right? And so, right, that's the kind of ironic part of it, is that they will use exculpatory speech to show intent, right? Or to show that the intent that Jack Smith thinks that Donald Trump had is incorrect, and argue that before a jury, but they think when it's used on the flip side to show intent, that that's an impermissible criminalization of speech rather than evidence that illuminates the motivation behind the allegedly unlawful conduct.
And just for the benefit of our listeners, what do you mean by exculpatory?
Yeah, so of course, by exculpatory, I mean something that would reveal a person's innocence. So, right, Donald Trump, for example, going on to social media and saying, right, disperse, be peaceful, don't engage in violence, that would be evidence to suggest that he did not want to incite a mob on January 6th. Although I think, right, you get the pushback that, that was done kind of forcibly and half-heartedly. And so maybe that exculpatory evidence, or I should say, quote unquote, exculpatory evidence is actually more damning than it is, suggesting that he's in fact, he didn't mean for that to occur.
There's so much for us to be paying attention to, and that we will continue to pay attention to as these various trials unfold. And as you mentioned, this is a case now that the Supreme Court will be weighing in on. And I guess I'll conclude with asking you the following for your commentary and take. The former president has been in the media lately speaking about the judges and the justices that he nominated, and with somewhat of a heavy hand, and almost seeming like an expectation that a kind of pressure. What do you make of that? Is that just a kind of Trumpism that, Trump is being Trump by making those kinds of statements? It's curious that these kinds of statements where he's reminding judges that he appointed them, that he nominated them, it's coming at a time in which Americans have lost confidence, at least in our Supreme Court, where it has the lowest approval and trust rating since ratings have actually ever taken place. What do you make of the kind of culture then of the former president making these articulations?
I think Donald Trump sees everything as transactional. And so he assumes that if he gave you something, whatever it is, of course, in this case, right, a judicial position, that you owe him in return in perpetuity. In some senses, I think it'll backfire on him because it might make some of the justices who he appointed, right, Justice Barrett, Justice Kavanaugh, Justice Gorsuch, and may give them some pause from ruling in their favor or in his favor, or at least maybe, might give them pause in terms of how they frame the issue. And it was certainly, I think there are a lot of terrible things about the Supreme Court I don't like. And there's probably no shortage of things. But for all of its institutional design flaws, the fact that we don't subject justices to popular elections and the like means that they don't have to do what Donald Trump says, and nobody can touch them for it, really. And I think that's the key thing here is that we saw something very similar with the judge in the civil trial over E. Jean Carroll, where Donald Trump tried to browbeat Judge Kaplan and essentially call Judge Kaplan every name in the book. But of course, that judge sitting in a federal judiciary doesn't care what Donald Trump says and does, because even if Donald Trump becomes president again in 2025, then there's nothing that Donald Trump could do, right? The position is secure. And so I think that's the biggest thing here is that I'm not really sure what Donald Trump thinks he's going to achieve here. I think he's actually doing himself, again, I'm not really here to give Donald Trump advice, but he's doing himself more harm by making these judges look like they are his puppets, because either it'll undermine the legitimacy of any decision that they render, which is in his favor, or right, it'll give them pause to not rule so earnestly in his favor. And that's, neither of those things are a position he really wants, but Donald Trump has never really done the thing that is most logical, at least in the legal system, from my perspective.
And with that, I want to thank you again for joining us. We really appreciate the insights and the expertise that you offer. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Guests and listeners, that's it for today's episode of On the Issues with Michelle Goodwin at Ms. Magazine. I want to thank each of you for tuning in for the full story and engaging with us. We hope you'll join us again for our next episode, where you know we'll be reporting, rebelling, and telling it just like it is. For more information about what we discussed today, head to MsMagazine.com and be sure to subscribe. And if you believe, as we do, that women's voices matter, that equality for all persons cannot be delayed, and that rebuilding America and being unbought and unbossed and reclaiming our time are important, then be sure to rate, review, and subscribe to On the Issues with Michelle Goodwin at Ms. Magazine in Apple Podcasts, Spotify, iHeartRadio, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, wherever it is that you receive your podcast. We are ad-free and reader-supported. Help us reach new listeners by bringing this hard-hitting content in which you've come to expect and rely upon by subscribing. Let us know what you think about our show, and please support independent feminist media. Look for us at MsMagazine.com for new content and special episode updates. And if you want to reach us, please do so. Email us at ontheissues@MsMagazine.com. We do read our mail. This has been your host, Michelle Goodwin, reporting, rebelling, and telling it just like it is. On the Issues with Michelle Goodwin is a Ms. Magazine joint production. Michelle Goodwin and Kathy Spiller are our executive producers. Our producers for this episode are Roxy Zoll, Oliver Hogg, and also Allison Whelan. Our social media content producer is Sophia Panagrahi. The creative vision behind our work includes art and design by Brandy Phipps, editing by Holland, and music by Chris J. Lee.